Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming here today. I'd first like to acknowledge my co-authors, Cleo Caldwell, Jose Bauermeister, and Mark Zimmerman from the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Now, as you heard, a lot of my work is with Latino populations, but today I'm going to talk about a study that looked at the trajectories of risk for violent behaviors among African Americans here, obviously, in the United States. Now, none of the authors have any financial relationships to disclose. Now, the ages of 18 through 25 have been described as this emerging adulthood period, and they have been also described as a period of transition where youth are much more independent from their parents but have yet to really take on all of the responsibilities of adulthood. Now, this transition is sometimes accompanied by but what I like to describe as a second period of identity exploration and confusion. And this can bring about instability in social roles, particularly in family and romantic relationships, as well as in labor choices. Now, as we know, these factors might increase the risk for a number of negative outcomes, particularly mental health and behavioral outcomes. However, this period is also accompanied by a lot of positive factors. For example, people are much more likely to go into college throughout this period. They also are more likely to delay childbearing, as well as create social networks outside of their communities of origin. Now, previous studies have shown that transitions are really vary by race, ethnicity, gender and socioeconomic status, with African Americans, women, and people in lower SES groups transitioning at earlier ages than whites, males, and more affluent groups. Other studies have also shown that the racial, gender, and SES transitions tend to vary by life domain. So, for example, compared to whites, African Americans transition at an earlier age into parenthood, but they transition at a later age when it comes to financial independence and having an independent household. Now, general strain theory has been widely used to explore violent behaviors among a number of groups, and it's essentially stating that exposure to different negative life events will increase the strain and stress among populations, and that ultimately might increase the risk for a number of negative mental health and behavioral outcomes, but in particular for violent behaviors. Now, one of the critical gaps in the literature is really understanding what kinds of stressors are most relevant for each group and how the accumulation of those stressors increases the risk for violent behaviors. Now, we know that African Americans, for example, have a greater exposure to stressors such as financial strain, racial discrimination stress, different types of neighborhood stress, and early parenting roles, and that they actually are also exposed to these stressors for a longer time, starting sometimes during childhood. Now, we have three main questions that we looked at, and essentially it's during this period of emerging adulthood, we want to know the relative risk, not in the epidemiological sense, but sort of the contribution of each of the specific life domains and stressors in specific life domains on violent behaviors. Secondly, we'd like to know how the accumulation of these stressors affects risk across the emerging adulthood period. And finally, how do level of education and gender moderate these relationships? So in order to answer these questions, we use data from the Flint Adolescent Study, led by Mark Zimmerman at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Now, this is a panel study that has followed participants starting in the ninth grade in about 1994, and we just finished the 11th wave of data collection this year, so they are now well into adulthood. Now, the original study has 850 participants, but we are focusing on the African American subsample, which actually made up the majority of the sample, so we have 604 participants in the study. Roughly half of them were males, and the average age during wave one baseline was 15, making the average age during waves 5 through 8, which is our sort of the waves that correspond to that emerging adulthood period, starting at 20 and ending at 23, although the range was from 19 through 25 years of age.
And
the same person as the panel studying, right? So when it comes to educational attainment at wave 5, which corresponds to 1 year post expected high school graduation, we found that 24% of these participants had yet to complete high school. And at wave 8, so 4 years after their expected high school graduation rate, 13% had still to complete high school. We had a number of measures, and I'm going to briefly go through them. But age was calculated using the date of birth that was provided during wave 1. Violent behaviors was assessed using 6 items that looked at different types of behaviors, and particularly whether during the previous 12 months the participants had engaged in a one-to-one fight, on a group fight, whether they had purposely injured someone that ended up needing medical care, whether they had carried a gun or a knife or a razor, whether they had used a gun or a knife to steal something from somebody. Now, we used the Cohen Perceived Stress Scale to assess whether participants felt that they could handle the daily hassles in their lives. We created a financial shortage measure using 3 items that asked participants whether, compared to other people, they felt that they had enough money to cover their food, clothing, and medical care expenses. Now, the response categories for these were more than enough, just enough, or not enough. And so we summed these, and higher numbers indicate more financial shortage. Now, we used the parenting stress index short form, six item short form, and this particular measure asked the participants who had reported having a child about their role as caregivers and how overwhelmed really they felt with parental responsibilities. Now, we used 7 items to address neighborhood stress, and we asked people to rate how they felt about their neighborhoods in general and their neighbors, as well as sort of their fear of violence in the neighborhood. We also used the daily life experience subscale developed by Shelley Harrell to look at racial discrimination stress. And this particular subscale asked participants whether they had experienced a racism-related event and how much it bothered them. So it's a weighted scale. And finally, we created an accumulation of stressors indicator, which we used specific life domain for each specific life domain, we used specific cutoff points and created binary measures and then summed these for each wave and then looked at the accumulation of them over time. Now, in terms of analysis, we use multi-level growth curve models, which allow us to look at the trajectories of change or risk for each individual and how internally and then how that compares to other individuals in the sample. Now, we ran 2 analyses. The first was looking at each of these specific life domain factors, and the second, we looked at the accumulation of stressors and risk for violent behaviors across time. And in both, we included cross-level interactions of gender and level of education to look at moderator effects. We used the natural log of violent behaviors. As we know, violent behaviors tend to be fairly skewed, so this was sort of the best way to go around that. And we standardized all of the continuous variables to be able to compare and to sort of have a simpler explanation in terms of the outcome variables. Now, without looking at any of the stressors of the accumulation of stress, we found that, consistent with the literature, males had higher risk for violent behaviors than females, and those that had not finished high school on time had a higher risk for violent behaviors than those who had finished high school on time. And these relationships were actually very consistent when we did look at specific life domain stressors as well as the accumulation of risk. Now, when it comes to the results on our first research questions about the specific life domains, we found that perceived stress and racial discrimination stress did, in fact, increase the risk for violent behaviors during the emerging adulthood period, and sometimes quite dramatically. However, none of the other types of stressors during that time had an impact in either direction for risk for violent behaviors. And again, gender and level of education were consistent. In our second question, we then wanted to compare those with zero or one stressors, which we collapsed into a single category, to those that had two, three, four, or five stressors. And we found that there was actually no difference between having zero or one or two or three stressors. People seemed to be able to cope with that level of stress. But we did find that people with four and five stressors actually had a much higher risk for violent behaviors. And again, gender and level of education were consistent. Now, this study has a couple of limitations that we should mention. First of all, we didn't really look at the context of violence, so we're not really sure whether these incidents happened in the family or in the community, whether it was with people who they knew or with people that they didn't know. We also were only able to look at five different life domains, and in at least in one of the cases, it was really a proxy for stress. When we looked at financial shortage, we did, in fact, look at financial shortage, but we didn't ask participants how they felt about their financial shortage or whether they thought that was fair. And those are actually factors in general strain theory points as important to understand the pathways for violent behaviors. Now, in this particular study, we didn't look at sources of social support or different emotions such as anger, which, again, are important predictors in the pathway for violent behavior, but we will be doing that in the next steps for this study. Now, some of our non-findings with regard to parenting, neighborhood, and financial stress in particular may, in fact, be due to the fact that we were only looking at a very specific age range and sort of a short age range. So in a future study, we're going to be looking starting during adolescence into adulthood and sort of increasing that variability and see what pops up there. And finally, this is a study that was among African Americans to a very specific Midwestern city, and it's important to really look at whether the patterns that we found are also replicated in studies among other populations and in other geographic contexts. Now, despite these limitations, this is one of the studies that one of the first studies to compare the specific life domain stressors and to do so longitudinally across this population. We have a few very important findings. Now, it seems when it comes to the accumulation of stress that there in fact is sort of a tipping point that pushes people over the edge in terms of their risk for violent behaviors. And if our study is any indication, it seems to be sort of four stressors. The other part is that, you know, there's stress and then there's stress, right? Stress is generally not perceived as a good thing, but when it comes to risk for violent behaviors, it seems that racial discrimination stress in particular is very problematic and is increasing the risk for violence. Now, thinking about this a little bit more, we really have to sort of teach people how to deal with issues of discrimination, but we also need to start a more concentrated effort on eliminating instances of discrimination, particularly institutionalized forms of discrimination. And that's something that a lot of the work that we've been doing has started to go in that direction. And finally, we also need to understand that poor people of color tend to be exposed to more stressors in different life domains and that they start at much earlier ages. So we have a population that has increased risk, but we also need to understand why and how structural forms of institutionalized racism are in fact affecting and sort of keeping folks within those silos. Now, we'd like to acknowledge NIDA for their very generous support throughout 11 waves of data collection. And also Emily Pingle, the Flynn Adolescent Research Study team, and Kathy Welch at the University of Michigan, and Megan Foster at the Brown School at WashU. Now I'm going to open up for questions. Yes.
Of financial hardship as
Well, you know, we were actually pretty surprised that financial shortage did not emerge as one of the important predictors. We were expecting that racial discrimination was going to emerge as one of them because we had done preliminary studies on that. But when it comes to stress, I mean, it's all perceived stress, right? And I think that there, in the literature, and I've spoken to some senior scholars on this, it seems to be that when we talk about racial discrimination, there tends to be a higher bar, and we have to say, well, it's actually perceived racial discrimination and not actual racial discrimination. And we don't do that with other forms of stressors. And really all forms of stressors are the, you know, that's why it stresses you out, because it's that perception of stress. But we did look at those independently, and we also sort of were controlling with that perceived stress, sort of that daily hassles scale. So the fact that it still emerged as significant, even though we were including other factors, is, you know, it says a lot about what people are going through. Yep.
Well, I just add as a comment that racial discrimination is against you as the way you look, as opposed to everybody can be poor. And so it's you know, you're being targeted as an individual, so it's a stress that you're specifically the victim of,
right,
as opposed to a generalized low income or, you know, the economy's down. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then we see this a lot in Massachusetts. We have a big patient community. A number of health people have a hard time seeing the patient community as being the victims of racial discrimination because they're Haitian. I mean, the white research community makes its own odd distinctions that you really have to sort of like dig into. And my question, I guess, is this male and female? I'm sorry.
Both, yes, male and females. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the literature, or in our study? She's asking what was the age of that transition. So you're asking about sort of what we found in the literature, or? So in the general literature, that has been that was not one of the parts of our study, but we found that African American females tend to transition earlier into parenthood roles. And also into romantic relationships, into very sort of stable romantic relationships, as opposed to white females. Different studies have looked at it somewhat differently, and it ended up starting in late adolescence, sort of 18, 19 years old, into the very early 20s, sort of a cutoff point of 23. Those studies have not compared with Latino females. Those have been studies with black and white comparisons. Right. You'd be surprised at the things that we tend to know and that the establishment doesn't seem to listen. Right.
So is there any plan to look at, you know, actually say taking the word perception out and think if that helps to move them to a better sense?
That has a number of potential answers. I think that the moment is now, right? I don't think that we should be waiting any longer to really validate what people are experiencing. I think that also when it comes to the science, you know, the scientific and the NIH folks, they don't seem to be wanting to let go of that. It's perceived discrimination language, and I'm not really sure why. And I've sort of picked people's brains to see what's going on, and there seems to be a really intense, serious debate going on within the walls of NIH and scientists in review panels for different people's research. There was a story that one of our senior faculty members who's now at Harvard told us, where they were reviewing a really solid study, and there was one person who kept saying, well, this is perceived discrimination, and that was sort of their first critique. Then their second critique was, well, we can't do anything about their perception of their being discriminated, so we shouldn't be funding the study. And ultimately, the study didn't get funded, even though the science behind it was really solid. So there has to be, I think that within the scientific community, a much more open dialogue of what's going on. And you know, we have to have our voices be heard in a way that right now we haven't been. There's a couple of questions.
Part of the answer to your question is you've touched on an issue of scientific methodology. I can ask people their perceptions. I'm using it as a proxy for real racism. I can't ask them objectively about the racist events because I haven't been following them through their lives. Part of the problem is to accurately describe what I have just studied, I talk about it as perceived racism. I'm not sure our methods have the ability to get past that, but part of the problem here is that there's a translational issue. I'm using it to get as a proxy for real racism. Other people are walking away saying it's only your perception, it's not real. That translation we should be able to get past if it's only in the press release.
There's a hand in the back. Hey, Cleo.
As someone who does perceive, one of the things that happens in African America, I know what I do to make it real, and I know that it's not a perception, it's real. But in order to get published as a scientist, I know I have to use the terminology perceived racism. But I also know my reality is very different than the scientific community is willing to accept.
Where's that hand? Yannick, I think you're.
About
Well, that comes, again, that's sort of a multi-tiered answer. And I guess that it depends on which institutions we're talking about. I mean, I know, for example, in the federal government, even people have different ideas and they sort of their own perceptions about race and gender and sexual orientation, all these things. But when something comes out and people are trained within their institutions, at least initially, there seems to be a drop in instances of discrimination. And there's changes in the way that things are done, right? Protocols and the way things are done. So that's one way, but obviously there's other forms of institutionalized racism in the banking industry, for example, in housing, and then sort of these other arenas, and we need to sort of think creatively on how to do that as well. I don't have a definitive answer on that, but I think that my thinking is going in that direction. There was one more hand here.
Yeah.
One last comment.
Well, I just wanted to go back to a question, because when you look at the youth risk behavior survey, you know, and the question is asked, are you bullied on the way home outside of school property? That's one of the questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, are you perceived bullied?
Right.
It is bullied. But when we're talking about discrimination, this adjective has to get inserted.
Right.
So, you know, I understand the scientific part of it, but I think there's like, okay, everything that has to be perceived as opposed to this one insult.
Right. I mean, I try to, at least with my students, for example, that's one of the things. I teach research methods at the Brown School, and that's one of the factors that we've been really talking about is sort of these labels for different phenomenon. And when it comes to research on health disparities more broadly, and there's a number of factors that we just hold them to a higher standard because we don't believe them when they're telling us what they're telling us. And I think that is one of the most pervasive forms of institutionalized racism within the scientific community. So that's something to sort of think about and try to move forward. Thank you very much.